This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Catherine Powell Warren, a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Ghent, to talk about her new monograph, Gender and Self-Fashioning at the Intersection of Art and Science, Agnes Blok, Botany, and Networks in the Dutch 17th Century, out this year, 2024, with the Amsterdam University Press. Hello, Catherine, and welcome to the program.
Hello, Yana. Thank you for having me.
This is wonderful. How are you today?
I'm doing well, thank you. I'm excited to be talking about this book, which has been a long time in the making, and I feel that finally an important woman is getting her due.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And you've spent a long time with her. How long have you been with her? How did you come to write this book?
I began actually when I was working on my PhD in 2016, and I knew I wanted to look at women in the arts, and I knew that there had to be more than one or two very famous artists. And that's how I came across first Maria Sibylla Merian, the wonderful botanical illustrator and naturalist, and then who used to do work for Agnes Blok. And so I traveled to the Rijksmuseum at Amsterdam, and as is so often the case, a wonderful librarian put in my hands an album of delightful flowers that I couldn't stop looking at. And that's how I came to devote 6-7 years of time to Agnes Blok.
That's 6 or 7 years sounds about right. That's wonderful. Just quick note, librarians, the best people on the planet.
Absolutely. They are so kind and they know everything. Everything.
Everything. It's astounding. Yeah, I think we can split the world in between people who understand the glory of the librarian and the people who are sad and don't know it.
Absolutely. And in this case, I had requested, I was new to the institution. I was very junior. I didn't really know how anything worked. I certainly did not speak Dutch. And this wonderful librarian said, if you requested these other materials, I think you'll like what I'm going to bring you. And she brought out this wonderful florilegium illustrated by some of the most famous artists of the 17th century. And all that was known about it was that it had come into the collection of the Rijksmuseum immediately after the Second World War, and nobody had looked at it. And she said, I think you'll like this. And how much of a wonderful feat of synchronicity that is.
Yeah, absolutely. And now the world knows about this through you and her. So thanks to both of you for Agnes Blok. Speaking of, who is she? Who is this Agnes Blok character?
You know, she was, I think, a fascinating woman. I'd like to think she would have been opinionated and very strong-willed. This is a woman who was born in 1629. She was a member of the Mennonite community in the northern Netherlands, what we think of the Netherlands today. At the time, the history is a little bit complicated there. But she came to live, she was orphaned at a young age. She came to live in Amsterdam with her aunt and uncle. And then she went on to have a life that was really set to her own path in this sense. She married late, but she was already wealthy. She had already done a lot of she was a self-taught because, of course, she didn't attend university or anything like that. But she was obviously very smart and was an uncommon reader. She accumulated books and she developed a passion for flowers and plants. And so it was that after her first husband died, she bought a country estate out near Utrecht. And it was on the water. And this was a common thing for very wealthy people to do. Because you can imagine Amsterdam in the summer, it did not smell all that terrific. And a lot of people just wanted to get out as they do today. In New York, you go to the Hamptons. If you lived in Amsterdam, you went out along the River Vecht. And so she bought a property that was really just a farm. And over the course of three decades or so, she developed it to have gardens, a greenhouse. It was a new contraption at the time. Birds, she kept an aviary, she kept an apiary. She amassed a huge collection of watercolors and artworks to the point where people like John Evelyn in England said, if anybody goes to Holland, you have to stop and go visit this woman's garden. So her claim to fame, her posterity, was that she was the first person to grow a pineapple to maturity in Northern Europe, which I think is wonderful because anybody who's been to Northern Europe knows that this is not pineapple growing country. So this is, in a nutshell, who this wonderful woman was. And she, over the course of her life, primarily those three decades, she gave work to at least 20 artists. And we're talking about the most famous artists of the time. And that's what I thought was really remarkable.
Yeah, I feel like we need to contextualize a little bit, because when we say Mennonite, that probably evokes some images for the modern reader, which are no longer appropriate, right? The Mennonites were prosperous. They were a dominant sect here, yeah?
Absolutely. So Amsterdam was a bit of a funny place. It's known for its tolerance, and it was the same in the 17th century. So officially, the city was a place where the Reformed Church was the official religion. But there were Catholics, there were Jews, and there were Mennonites. So there were synagogues, Catholic churches, temples, and other meeting houses. These were not very secluded sects at all. They were prosperous. And the Mennonites in particular, their sort of primary characteristics is that they were known to be a very peaceful community. So they were not involved, for example, in colonial expansions as such, but they were very active traders, and particularly in textiles. And this is what Agnes Bloch's family did. So they were silk and textile traders. So they were a very prosperous community, and they were not marginalized. The only difference is that they could not become mayor, for example, or other official. They would not be part of a civic militia. But otherwise, there were no real barriers or exclusions, but it was a very closely knit community. And I think that's where it matters a little bit, because there were a number of major families, and there was a lot of intermarriage, and they kept everything really closely related.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, very few people are going to be the Burgermeister. Like, that is, the Burgermeister is not a, you know, that doesn't count out much. She's the niece by marriage of Joost van der Vondel, of Vondelpark fame. She lived on the Herengracht, which is the Gold Coast of Chicago. So, you know, like, she is one of the wealthiest and most connected women in the city.
Absolutely. Yes. And I think what's also to provide context, so what's special about her is that women did have limitations. And that's the conclusion I come to in my book, which is absolutely there were limitations that existed due to gender. So, for example, she was a passionate of botany and she was self-taught, and she required a lot of technical and scientific skills to grow the rare plants that she did. But she could have not joined, for example, the faculty of the botanical garden, which a lot of men, many of whom were less perhaps or no more educated than she was, were able to do. So she could not join the university. She could not join the Royal Society in London, which was really the most important scientific institution of the time. So these were the limits that were imposed upon her. And of course, she would have not boarded a ship to go look at flora or fauna elsewhere. So these were the kinds of limits that she experienced. But very much as is the case today, how much freedom and how much agency one is able to muster is very dependent on socioeconomic status. And that comes back to your point, which was she was one of the wealthiest women of Amsterdam. So those limits were not very real to her, in the sense that she managed still, she could still contact the burgomaster, the mayor of Amsterdam, and say, I'd be interested in getting a sample of this. And he would oblige her. So this was absolutely, she was able to make up for a lot of the disadvantages of her gender through wealth.
Sure. You know, while we're here, though, let's talk for a minute about the position of women in the early modern world. Because a lot of people who aren't historians are going to think that basically women are chattel until the 70s, you know, the 1970s, not the 1670s. And that really is, this is a place that we're right now really changing our opinion on this. Like, we as scholars are writing a new history, you know? So yes. I'd like you to talk for a minute about, like, there is kind of the, what you cited, the add women and stir idea of doing women's history, you know? So hey, will you fill our audience in on what that means, what I mean by that?
Yes. So it's, you know, if you have a collection of entirely male artists, for example, you have a gallery and they have 50 artists and all of them are male, you can add two or three famous female artists, hang their works on the walls and say, ha, I have a diverse gallery. But you don't. You really don't, because you've changed nothing. What a lot of scholars are trying to do today is to go back to the beginning. And basically, the idea is, if you continue to follow the same recipe, if you continue to follow the same methodologies, look for information in the same places, and adopt the same assumptions and sort of working hypotheses, not surprisingly, you're going to end up at the same place. So what scholars are finding, what I'm finding, is that women did have agency. Agnes Block, for example, she was able to enter into a marriage contract in which she retained all the money that she brought into the marriage upon death. So her money did not pass on to her husband's estate. She got to keep it. And she got part of her husband's estate. Her country house, which she named Pfeifferhof, which translates into pond court, so obviously there were many water features, she had a wonderful provision in her will, which said, if I die first, my husband, her second husband, can continue to live there for 2 years, provided that he pays rent and he pays for the upkeep. So this was hers. She was able to direct what she wanted. And there's a wonderful project at the University of Amsterdam called the Freedom of the Streets. And the researchers have been able to find that women did navigate around the streets of Amsterdam. They kept kiosks, of course. They were famous traders, so they kept businesses. They helped, and they very much participated. Yeah. Again, it's not to say that their lives was as easy as those of men. They, you know, if they found the project is very interesting, and that they found that women tended to stay closer to home. They tended not to be out in the evening, for example. So these are all clues about what it's like to be a woman. But I think it goes much further than the idea of the woman inside having no say at all and just being there to raise children and make sure that the meal is on the table at the appropriate time.
Yeah. You know, and if what we consider history is upper echelons of government and military battles, then we're only going to find men and we're going to think that only men had power.
Just so.
If we think about history as a collection of people walking around and living their lives, how about that? We're going to find women who matter, right? And so what you're doing here, as well as letting us know about Agnes, is really contributing to a broader understanding of early modern women in a way that hasn't been tainted by the Victorians.
Yes. And I think another pitfall, particularly as early modernists, what we experience is that the archives are, you know, the archives are so deeply flawed. They're wonderful. There's nothing quite like an afternoon spent in the archives, but they're at the same time so deeply flawed because their origins was to keep track of governments and institutions. And so there's been a long line, I think, of historians who think if there's no document to prove it, then how can we know for sure? And I agree. There's, you know, there's a lot of inferences that have to be made. The historian Sadia Hartman calls that a form of scholarly empathy, which is if you keep on voicing the silences that have created the invisibility of women in the first place, you're not helping. So in what I tried to do with Agnes Block is that we have only 11 letters, which is actually more than we have for most people, and they're to botanical expert in Italy, in Bologna. But in terms of her day-to-day life in Amsterdam and in the Netherlands, there's no record. But I proceeded, I thought, if she was into botany, maybe the famous botanists of the time knew her. And sure enough, I found her name mentioned in botanical treatises. And then I was able to find artworks that probably belonged to her. And that's how you can build a network and sort of instead of looking for Agnes Block in the archives, which does not yield a lot, if you start by looking at objects and other sort of trails of associations, I find there's really a lot to be discovered.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
And you know, now it's a little bit easier. Now you've made one more step to being able to find this kind of slightly occult history of how women in the sciences and the Dutch Republic. So thanks for that. you know, why are there no artists? You know, why are there no great women artists? Well, we haven't looked for them. You know,
it's partly we haven't looked for them, partly because, you know, what is art? The fixation on panel paintings, for example, her collection of art, and she was never really on the radar. And that's one of the things I find astonishing, is that this is a woman who commissioned and gave work to at least 20 artists over a period of 30 years or so, but she was never in the sort of collections of great patrons. And a big reason for that is because she collected watercolors of natural history. And so is that not art? Which, of course it is. And just even looking at her collection of art, I discovered, I learned more about several women artists. And once again, they're not in the guilds. They're not recognized because, you know, pictures of flowers in watercolor. But so that's, you know, that's one problem. Why have there been no great women artists? What is art? And at the same time, what does it mean to be the author of an artwork? Mm-hmm. Yeah. These are all assumptions we've made.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, hey, we talked about, you mentioned the Weiberhof quickly. Let's go back. What is this place? Tell me more about this place, the Pond Court.
The Pond Court. So this is an estate we've been fortunate. There have been a lot of terrific period shows on television, Downton Abbey, for example, which is one with which most people are familiar. So it was not that. Dutch country houses tended to be far more modest. It was still a beautiful, big enough house, but it was far more modest than what you'd find, for example, in Downton Abbey. And it was a property. They tended to be much smaller than what you think about an English country and state, because quite simply, there's not a lot of land in the Dutch Republic. And so she had a parcel that was on the river. There would have been a house. The house was big enough to have, of course, several rooms and a library. We know she had a library. We know she had a kitchen with access to a flower garden and a kitchen garden and the apiary. So her bees were kept near there. There would have been an aviary, which would be quite large because she kept a lot of exotic birds. So this would have been a place where, a little bit like you find at a zoo today. So there would have been a cage, and then there were also some birds that did not fly. So there was a place for people to gather and look on and see what the birds were, observe them. And of course, artists would have been able to do the same thing. And then the showpiece of the property would have been that sort of orangery and greenhouse combination where she kept, I found a catalog of the plants that were sold when she passed away in 1704. And to, again, for listeners, it may sound odd, but plants, they were rarities. The plants she collected, they were worth an enormous amount of money. And wealthy and knowledgeable individuals at the time collected plants the way they collected porcelain and coins and metals. So this was really a status collection in addition to being scientifically very interesting. And there were over 1,000 specimens that were sold, some very rare. Her collection spanned South America, Africa, Indonesia, basically the Dutch colonial world. So she had it all. That would have been the showpiece. It would have been a pleasant estate that is described in a poem and where people would have been led on a tour. And the whole thing would have been just peaceful, pleasant, by the water. Ending the tour would have ended probably through the library. There would have been a room where she kept all of her collections, because she also had books and medals and coins and arts and everything.
You know, so you say, don't think Downton Abbey, think something more, more modest. But at the same time, this represents an amazing amount of wealth and power and holy mackerel, right?
Extraordinary. And I forgot to mention, there would have probably been guest quarters on the estate. And I suspect that artists did come and go and spend time there to capture that collection. Her collection was really, she was asking for portraits of her flowers, I think is the best way to think about it, which is astonishing. And because of that, there would have been something of an artistic community that developed around the property, which is fantastic. But yes, absolutely, there was a lot of money.
An amazing amount of just resources going into this. And then put her in context. Does she stand out for this estate, or are there going to be other places similar to this?
She does stand out. There were other places, obviously other women. There was a woman even named Magdalena Poole, who had an estate with also quite a collection, not far from where Agnes Bloch was. But what was special about her estate was not the size of the house or even the sort of accoutrements, the parterres and the sculptures, but it was the quality of her botanical collection, which rivaled those of the botanical gardens in Amsterdam and in Leiden. And in fact, we know that she provided the botanical gardens with many specimens. So she would share with them and they would share with her. So there are two things that stand out. The first one is just the sheer quality and quantity of her botanical collection. And the second is her collection of artworks and watercolor. There's no comparable collection by a private individual. So the Botanical Garden commissioned something that was very rich, a collection of 9 volumes of plants and flowers on parchment. But that was a commission by the city. And she had at least 500 to 600, I would imagine, watercolors. So her collection was really unrivaled, and that made her very special.
What does this tell us about like the Dutch and their ideas about themselves and what we're, you know, in this period we're going to come to call the Golden Age?
Yes. The Golden Age, such a tricky term, of course. Mm-hmm. But for Agnes Blok, fair enough, this was a golden period. The Dutch were, in the 17th century, they were enormously successful. They had established primacy in trade. They were the masters of the seas. And so they were able to go everywhere. They had very wealthy and productive colonies in Indonesia, the coast of India, Malabar, also at in South Africa today. So then last in South America, Brazil, and Suriname. So this was an extraordinarily wealthy country. Lots of trades. They were first in trade for grain, and pretty much anybody who traded to Europe had to come through Amsterdam, so they collected a lot of duties and so on. But part of this wealth was to be displayed as the Garden of Eden. And the Dutch, those who know the history of the Republic, fully 1/3 of the land that is there was reclaimed from the sea. So they pumped the water out to make land. So when you land today in Amsterdam, you're actually some 3 meters below sea level. So that is part of what they thought as their dominion over nature. They saw themselves as a chosen people living in the Garden of Eden. They had dominion over nature, and there was no better way to demonstrate that and their just incredible power in trade and sovereignty as to have those botanical collections. So the nature, the pursuit of nature, the pursuit of gardens is, it really becomes a national passion, which is why I think it's also, it was something that I thought was important to highlight in the book, in that this is not a woman who's decided to pursue flowers and she's just an odd person with an odd marginal pastime. She is somebody who really inscribes herself into the national identity. And indeed, she chooses for herself to represent, to be represented as Flora Batava. So the Batava is the name that the Dutch gave to themselves in memory of the ancient Batavians who just triumphed. And she places herself as the goddess of flowers of the Dutch Republic. And this is her identity. And I think it fits absolutely with what the Dutch thought of themselves and what was happening. This was just a bubbling country full of creativity and just might to do things and curiosity.
Yeah. You know, God may have created the world, but the Dutch made the Netherlands. And
yes.
And flowers, which remain a national obsession. So, you know, you do the math, listeners, if we're talking about how important botanicals are and how important this woman is in the world of botanicals. Like, geez, this is a big deal. And so she sits apart here, and then we've got, it's kind of happening in a contemporaneously, the development of the field of natural history. So what does that involve? What do I mean by the field of natural history?
Well, it's there's an author whom I admire named Eric Yorink, and he's written about reading the book of nature. And there's sort of this shift where religion and devotion to God naturally brings devotion to nature and contemplation over the creation of the world. But then there's a shift sort of mid-17th century where instead of just contemplating nature and thinking of it as a creation of God, there's this desire to start to classify it, to describe it, to understand it. So particularly with botany, which from the Middle Ages had been associated with women and apothecaries and remedy and that whole, the healing, if you will, part of the world and activity, the field of activity, all of a sudden it becomes more serious. So it is institutionalized. That's when you start having, now in Italy, it begins earlier in the 16th century, but the importance of botanical gardens, that happens throughout Europe, including in the Dutch Republic. And as these specialties develop, and you have a period of stability after the 30-year war, and so people start learning more and classifying and wanting to know. And then there's in 1660, there's the Royal Society that is founded in London that is specifically to try to encourage this new mode of empiricism. The impact is for women is that as this new science, the fascination, of course, with exploration and colonial expansion comes at the expense of what was happening in the domestic world. So much science earlier would have happened in the kitchen, in the apothecary, which was associated with the home. But all of a sudden, there are anatomical theaters, there are botanical gardens, and there are universities and places where people go to do that. Latin becomes the lingua franca. Women don't have access to formal education. And I'm speaking of Northern Europe. It was different in Italy, but by and large, it's much more difficult to become fluent in Latin if you're a woman than if you are a man. You don't have access to university, again, in the North. And so you're stuck, and women become increasingly marginalized. So that's the development of early modern science, which is, on the one hand, it's wonderful because there's communication. You have reports from the 1660s where they talk about the experiments that are being carried out and what they're learning and what they're seeing. So there's that dissemination of knowledge, but it also becomes more exclusionary.
Mm-hmm. And the quantification and the codifying everything. We've got encyclopedias, we've got plates, ephemera is captured into images that are categorized and sent around. And yeah, that's great. But there's as things become professionalized, right, we see women and a lot of groups become they're excluded from the production of knowledge.
Exactly. And one fabulous example is that the scientists, for example, and I refer to the Royal Society because it was probably the most important international organization. A lot of people from the Dutch Republic belong to it. So the Royal Society refers consistently to information they get from fishermen about several species of fish or shells that they collect. They rely on indigenous people. They rely on knowledge they obtain from women and a number of other people, but not one of them could ever gain admission into the Royal Society. And indeed, there's no woman in the Royal Society until, I think the date is 1954. Something like that. So it's the middle of the 20th century. So the knowledge is still recognized in a way, but it has to be legitimized by somebody else.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I get it. And then there's this fashioning process as well, where it's described and you get to, somebody is in charge of determining what matters. God forbid we have a talk without mentioning or referencing Foucault somehow, but somebody gets to decide what is important here.
That's right.
Yeah. And but that process
what is important.
what's important, who's like, and who makes knowledge, and what is worth writing down, what we learn, what matters. But you see this process as well, kind of on a similar frame with the idea of self-fashioning. You know, this is what she's doing as well. Agnes is deciding what's going to be left for posterity. What is the image she wants to make? What matters? And chapter four is dedicated to Bloch's self-fashioning. And I just kept thinking about this as like this little microcosm of what's happening everywhere else too, right? She's just, but her canvas is herself. Anyway, this is what I was thinking. Please tell me what you were thinking, which is actually kind of more the point with this interview. Sorry.
No, I think you're absolutely right. What's interesting with self-fashioning is that it's a reflection. The more, I'd like to think that the more aware Agnes Bloch, for example, becomes of what is happening around her. She, you know, we would now call Poland, there's a Polish botanist who comes to visit her. There's an English botanist who comes to visit her. She sees people from all over the place. She interacts with people from all over the place. So the more aware she becomes of the world around her, the more aware she becomes or conscious she becomes of how she wants to be perceived. And I think that's a natural impulse. And it occurred in the early modern period just as much as it occurs today. So, you know, you see that with teenagers, which is the larger the school they go to, the more conscious they are about their appearance and what their peers are going to think about them. So that's a little bit the same with Agnes Bloch. So as her world expands, she becomes very acutely aware of her place in it and what she wants that place to be. Now, listeners, of course, being a mother was important. She was not a mother. She was a stepmother. She never had children of her own. She had many godnieces, godchildren. She had nieces, she had nephews, stepchildren, grandchildren. But that's not how she wanted to be remembered. And to this day, a lot of people think of her as the pineapple lady because she made a point of having a portrait of her with two grandchildren and her husband, but the pineapple is there. Mm. And she has a medal. And when we say medal, listeners should understand this is about 4 inches in diameter. So this is not something you wear around your neck. It's a token you display. And if she has it designed and cast in bronze and silver, apparently there was a gold exemplar. And on the one side is her, a portrait of her like a Roman emperor. And she's a wizened woman looking into the distance. And on the verso of the medal is her personal motto, which is art and science can succeed where nature just doesn't quite reach, where nature falls short. There's Flora Batava and there's the pineapple. So this is part of a very specific iconographic program where she decides how she will be remembered.
Yeah, I think the kids would call it curating her brand, right?
Exactly. She was, you know, in a way, she was always curating her brand. And some people think, well, how certain can you be that she was doing that? We have no record. She doesn't write Dear Diary. I'm very concerned about my posterity. But I think when you take the whole, the medal, the portraits of her, the fact that in her portrait, for example, she is holding one of her watercolors. You know, so there's so much self-reference that it cannot be accidental.
Only this. I mean, there's a language too. We understand how portraits are made. We know that, you know, there's iconographic images that people put in their portraits and artists paint to let you know who they are. Like, we know the process that she's following. She didn't invent this. She's part of, so, you know, how do we know she's doing that? Well, the same way we know everyone's doing it.
That's right. And she knew she'd grown up around a very wealthy family that collected art, that engaged in those self-fashioning practices. You know, she was around her, both of her husbands, her family were involved in the silk trade. And she knew you don't make money unless you're recognized as providing something special. And her provision of something special was knowledge and the patronage of the arts, and that's how she wanted to be seen.
Yeah. And then another part of her self-fashioning, of her kind of her legacy that she's leaving, is the Blumen book and her collections. So, you know, before we finish up, let's talk about the Blumen book. What is this?
First, the Blumen book. It's a wonderful name, the Blumen book. It's a flower book. Agnes Bloch, as I said, she commissioned, the reason I say 500 or 600 watercolors is because we have no definitive inventory. But artworks, so these artworks were on paper. They were made by a variety of artists. Many of them are not signed. And what happened, I suspect, is once she felt near the 1690s that she had her collection, she had a good handle on what it is she wanted to accumulate, she had them bound. So these were individual sheets, which eventually were bound into volumes. Only one of these volumes survives. And that is the wonderful book that was presented to me in the Rijksmuseum, which we mentioned at the beginning. And this is an album with, I want to say, 194 individual sheets. And I was about to say in 194 flowers, but of course that's not accurate, because one of the things that Agnes Bloch did, which is wonderful, is she had several artists contribute to a single work. So there would be one page where it's clear to anybody spending time observing these works that they've made by different artists. The lines are different. Some of the things are added. In other parts, she cut out a flower and pasted it onto a page where there was already a flower. So it's a strange form of record of the collection she has, but these flowers are also exceptionally beautiful. They are works of art in and of themselves. And some of them, some of the works from her collection have become separated from their albums, and they are shown in museum and kept as individual works of art. So that is that was the wonderful book. And I like to think of the Blumen book in two ways. The first way was a paper garden. It was a record of the flowers that she had grown, many of which did not survive. She lost species all the time, as is the wont of any gardener. You know that there's sort of inevitable process of decay and death. So it's a way to stop time, to memorialize her collection, and also to show her visitors, these are the things you can see or you could have seen in my garden. And from the another perspective, which is theoretical, but it's also a network. It's a materialization of a network of artists who come together in the pages of this book, whether Agnes Bloch put them together after the fact, or whether they worked on one page, passing the sheet back and forth. I think this Blumen book then really becomes the essence of what Agnes Bloch was all about.
Yeah. And she, you know, so it's this, and it's just gorgeous, right? Like it's stunning. These images are just beautiful. They're well done.
And you can tell she lavished a lot of care. Now we keep talking about money. To be clear for the listeners, the artists that she commissioned were at the top of their game. They were the most in demand. So they were not doing her favors. I'm certain that she paid dearly for all of these works, even though we have no record. And they are beautiful. And she, and one of the things that led me to conclude that the album was collated after the fact is that she organized the flowers by species and by color. Now we're talking, this is pre-Linnaeus, but so she'll have all of the irises together, and she'll have all the blue and purple irises followed by white ones, followed by pink ones. And she does the same with every species, and she has all of the vines together and all of her climbing plants. So this is evidence of a person who didn't just commission and say, didn't send an artist to say, I want you to paint everything that's in my greenhouse, but she knew what she was requesting. And on several of these works, now not in the Blumen book, but many hundreds of her works have found themselves in museums all around the world. And on some of them, we know that they came from her collection because she will make a note. This plant bloomed in July 1685. It was painted by Marianne Monnix or Herman Safkleven. And then she'll have a little note even of which botanical treatises you can refer to if you want more information. So it's a living testament to what she did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how, where she sits in the middle of this creation of knowledge as well and knowledge production, before Linnaeus, when it's still open for interpretation. There's a contest, or it's contested anyway. Like how do you categorize these plants? That's a thing she gets to do.
Absolutely, there's no standard taxonomy and there's no nomenclature. But so you can tell, she reads, she informs herself, and these notes sort of say, I'm aware of what is going on. I know what is happening. And that's so important. And the more we're exploring, a wonderful side effect of the recent focus of scholars on women artists and patrons is that there are now more and more people looking through their collections. And so many of these drawings are in private hands and they're popping up, or they're in museum collections and they've never been cataloged and now they are. And I've been working with the Fitzwilliam Museum, particularly Henrietta Ward, who's curator there. And we've set for ourselves a mission of trying to get an understanding of how large that collection was. And certainly there's a partial inventory that used to say the standard figure was about 400 works, but it might have been easily doubled that, is what we're finding. And we're following her annotations.
Wonderful. That's so cool. Oh, that's really exciting. God, I've got about 10 more tangents that I want to go on, but let's call it. We've got a good talk here, and I think we've really demonstrated the importance of gender self-fashioning and this network that she creates and the importance of Agnes Bloch. So we're good. So I've just got one more question. What are you doing now? What's next? This guy's in your hands, this book. Yay, covers.
This book is here. I just completed a monograph on Maria Sibylla Merian, which I'm very excited about. That'll be published by Lund Humphreys. And I'm looking still at the women who worked for Agnes Bloch. And I'm trying to understand what it meant to collaborate artistically if you're a woman at that time. So it's very exciting.
Yeah, that's very exciting. That's going to be a lot of fun work. Congratulations on that. All right. Hey, thank you so much for talking to me today and setting aside some time so we could have this chat. And I have really enjoyed it.
Thank you. It was a wonderful opportunity. Really enjoyed it.
All right. And we'll talk for the next one.